The following episode may contain inappropriate material. Listener discretion is advised.
Hi, this is Ben Wright Human, author of the webcomics Cost Pain and the Letters of the Devil, and you are listening to the PVD Cast.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another installment of the PVD Cast. I am your humble host and your podcast purveyor, John Orlando, and welcome to episode number 295. I hope all is well with you, and thank you for checking out this very special encore episode of the PVD Cast. Before I start talking about the guests that will be joining me here in a few moments, I'd like to just real quickly say that I really enjoyed my vacation, which is, of course, why there was not a PVD Cast episode last week. I enjoyed relaxing and visiting my mom and my stepdad in Rhode Island. So it was an awesome vacation, you know, especially with the fact that I haven't seen my folks since December of 2019, thanks to the pandemic. So it was great to just visit and hang out and see some sights and just relax. And I'm back and I'm ready to start giving you the podcast goodness that you come to expect from yours truly and the PVD Cast. Well, at the end of every episode, you know that I run down where you can catch the PVD Cast, and you're going to hear, starting with this episode, one outlet missing from that list. There is effectively no more Scene Snobs Network. So I'd like to talk just real quickly about it. Mick, the gentleman who is the driving force behind the Scene Snobs Network, due to some personal and professional issues that were going on with his life, has decided to put the network on a hiatus. And that sucks, but I totally understand. Sometimes I get overwhelmed, you know, dealing with just two podcasts, you know, the PVD Cast and Matt Talk. Mick, man, is running a network and in charge of, you might as well say, 30 plus podcasts. And I can only imagine the amount of stress that would cause. So with that, Mick, thank you very much to everybody with the Scene Snobs Network. It was so awesome to share that network with you and to collaborate with you and whatnot. And Mick, man, I hope your next project is as successful as the Scene Snobs was. And thanks again, man. Appreciate it. All right, let's talk about the details for this encore episode. Given the fact that I was on vacation, I did not get any recording done. So I reached into the vault and pulled out what I think is another favorite episode of mine. In fact, it's in the top three. And it's from last year, October 1st, 2020, to be exact, episode number 253. In which I spoke to two Hollywood stars, Jack O'Halloran and Bruce Valanche. And I feel like my part in that episode with Bruce Valanche was just so fun and so awesome that I'm going to go ahead and rebroadcast it. So I've trimmed out Bruce's conversation with me, and we talk about his career in Hollywood and his ties to Columbus and lots of other things. I think that you're going to enjoy this episode, especially if you didn't catch it last year. So with that being said, it's time for me to let you know about a great sponsor. And of course, I'm talking about World's Greatest Comics. They're located at 5974 Westerville Road in Westerville, Ohio. And they've got tons of comics from every era, the golden, silver, bronze, and modern era. But they also have graphic novels, toys, comic book supplies, collectibles, posters, back issues. They have a great pull system. Basically, they got everything that you need. So stop on over to the store and say hi to Jeff or any of the other fine folks at World's Greatest Comics. Or if you're not in the area, you can check them out online. Their website is wgcomics.com. And they're even on Facebook. Just search for @WGComics. And if you interact with anybody, please let them know that you heard about the store from me, John Orlando, right here on the PVD cast. With that being said, I'm going to throw it to a quick break. And on the other side of the break, you're going to hear my conversation with Bruce Valanche. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of the PVD cast. And joining me is a man that is a comedy writer, a songwriter, an actor, one heck of a nice guy, Bruce Valanche. How are you doing this afternoon?
Oh, I'm wonderful. I've changed my name. It's Quarantina Turner.
How has COVID been for you?
I've been in isolation since March 12th. So, I mean, you know, I've emerged. I don't know how it's going down in Ohio, but in Southern California, it's been pretty dire in the sense of lockdowns. I mean, people are taking it very seriously, and not seriously enough, evidently. But I mean, those of us who are, you know, we're basically working out of the house and emerging for things that we have to emerge for. Lately, there's been patio dining. I have been on more patios than any insect you know. You know, I mean, it's like now it's like autumn and it's going to turn off these notifications. They're so pesky. Speaking of insects, and when it gets cooler, you know, like the outdoor dining is not going to be so thrilling. So other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, I've been wonderful.
Well, you know, I'm going to start off with a pretty philosophical question for you. Given your long tenure as a comedy writer and given today's climate of cancel culture and political correctness and whatnot, do you feel that that comedy is entering into this weird new era of like caution when you're writing jokes and when you're doing bits?
I think it's killed a lot of comedy. I think that that people are just so damn sensitive. I mean, it's and I understand that. I mean, when you know, people make jokes about my several minorities, I get sensitive too, and I understand the whole concept of white privilege means that that you can't tell people that when they're that they shouldn't feel the way they do because you're not in their shoes. So it all adds up. It means you just have to tread so carefully, but you know you're going to wind up offending somebody. So you either can kind of go full bore, or you can just sort of retreat. There doesn't seem to be a whole lot of middle ground, and since so much is shut down, it's not been a terrible challenge. And also because the administration in Washington is so hilarious. If it weren't so deadly, it would be hilarious. I mean, it's just, you know, as the saying goes, you go to the circus and you get a clown. That's what happens.
Okay. So you were born in New Jersey. If I may ask, what kind of a child was Bruce Valanche?
Well, I was adopted, and I was 4 days old, so you know I always felt like I didn't belong there. But of course, I belonged where I was. I thought I was chubby, but now I'm looking at pictures of myself after my mother passed at 95. I suddenly inherited all of these scrapbooks, and I'm looking. I'm thinking, well, I'm not so chubby. She thought I was chubby. Now I get it. But I felt like I was a chubby kid. I wasn't athletic. That was the thing, you know. Back then, we didn't have the internet. We had a life of the mind. We had to have a fervent imagination because if you weren't athletic, you were nobody, and you were an egghead. And that was what I was. I mean, I was very interested in theater and movies and television, and I danced in front of the mirror. And my parents very wisely enabled all of that and let me go into summer stock companies and let me be a child actor, never a child star, or we'd be having this conversation in rehab. But I was a child actor. I did commercials and I was too big and my voice was too deep to really play kid parts. So I wound up playing parts I was too young for. And then as I aged into them, I was competing with the actors who really were the correct age. So that was when I found writing as a thing to do. And my parents were thrilled because they thought newspapers will never go out of style. Who knew?
But I was a popular kid because I performed in all the plays at school, and so I was visible, and I was, you know, editor of the newspaper, so I got around a lot, and which was kind of a solution to not being athletic and not being beautiful, which, you know, are the two fallback positions for every child.
When you just mentioned that you were a huge fan of movies, can I just ask, what are some of your favorite movies of all time?
Yeah, it's always difficult to say that because I'm much older than you are. So I probably have movies that you have a scant interest in.
Sure.
That are my favorites. I mean, my real favorite, when I mention the people, kind of like there's a profound silence, it's a movie called Tom Jones. It won the Oscar for Best Picture in 1964, way before you were born. Mm-hmm. But it was a huge hit at the time, and it started Albert Finney on a big career, and it's a fabulous movie. It's based on a Henry Fielding novel that was written in the 18th century, and it's really funny and really dirty and beautifully made. And a lot of movies look like it now because it started a lot of cinematic devices. But that being said, I mean, you know, I looked at the AFI list of 100 great movies. I thought it was hard to believe there were 100 movies that were better than All About Eve. That's because I love the theater, and it's such a literate movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Godfather movies are terrific. All the classics, you know, Citizen Kane, Singing in the Rain. Those are my favorites. I enjoy Star Wars. I was involved in Star Wars, but I am not a Star Wars person, you know, and I don't attach myself to any of those franchises particularly. So I feel, you know, in a way, kind of like behind the curve.
Okay.
I like a lot of the classic stuff. Am I alone here, or is it? No.
I enjoy. You did hit the nail on the head when you mentioned 1964. That was about 11 years before I was born. But no, I enjoy the classics too. I enjoy just a good story. I'll tell you. I'll be very honest with you, Bruce. One of the films that I saw during lockdown that I had heard about, and I really, really liked it, Harold and Maude. It was such an oddball film, but gosh darn it, it was really good.
It still is. I mean, it's a template for a lot of filmmakers when they make their first picture, reference Harold and Maude a great deal because it was what influenced them, and they kind of realized, well, I'm a little wacky and offbeat, and I could do a little something like this too. And Hal Ashby's whole career was interesting. I mean, he also made Shampoo, which is one of my favorite pictures, and is really kind of a brilliant political satire, and not just of politics, but of the society that keeps politics fueled with money.
Yes. Yes.
So I'd like to say Harold and Maude is a little whimsical, a little too much for my taste, although I love Ruth Gordon, and a little bit of her goes a long way. And Bud is a friend of mine, actually, and he's never, between that and Brewster McCloud, he's never lived down being sort of a geeky oddball. And now he's an old geeky oddball and doesn't know what to do with himself, doesn't know what to do about it. People, I mean, you know, it also appeals to, like, to younger people. It appeals to the macabre in all of us, you know, the idea of punking people, making mm-hmm. people think we're dead, you know, staging grim things that our parents tell us are, you know, are bad for us to be doing. That this, we're bad people. You know, it's a movie about that kind of rebellion.
And, you know, the other thing I was going to mention is I also enjoy those classics that are still, and you kind of mentioned it, are timely today. Like, I think of Network and A Face in the Crowd, how they touch on society and they touch on politics so well.
They're both, particularly on media manipulation, both of those movies.
Yeah.
Both Face in the Crowd and Network. And they were written by two legendary lefties, Bud Schulberg and Patty Chayefsky, who were the bane of Richard Nixon and all of those guys because they wrote from the left. They were two New York Jews, so that didn't make them terribly popular with the Washington establishment. And they were writing about the media being in the manipulative form of the media, about how you turn the media to what you want it to be. to get your agenda across, and it sort of presaged Fox News.
Mm-hmm.
Because that network that Faye Dunaway is running is just like Fox News. I mean, Fox News would put a fortune teller on if they hadn't done it in network. Fox News would be doing it now.
Well, I'm just a fan of film. I watch all kinds of films, new, old. I, much like you, would have a hard time narrowing down the list of favorite movies. So I think that's something we share in common, Bruce.
But, you know, also because some movies are favorites for, you know, the wrong reasons. I mean, favorite is such a wide-ranging thing. People assume that by favorite you mean good. Not
true.
Necessarily the case. In fact, I've been talking about doing a thing on Turner Classic, which of course only shows old movies, but they're inching into the 80s with some of their movies now. And a series about guilty pleasures, about movies we're not supposed to like, but we like them anyway for one crazy reason or another. And everybody would have a different kind of, you know, guilty pleasure. But mine is very show busy and campy and, you know, everything that's kind of a little bit overblown, overdone. Again, not to be confused with good.
Yes. Well, you talked a little bit off air. You are an Ohio State University alumni.
Aha.
Do you have any fond memories of Columbus?
Oh, my God. I remember, here was Columbus to me. There were two movie experiences. One was I had a roommate who was from Chillicothe and at Stradley Hall. And on campus my freshman year, and there was a movie theater at the corner of High Street and Lane Avenue, and it was the edge of campus, and it showed a lot of Swedish art films. They had a picture called I Am Curious Yellow that ran for a long time because there were lots of tits in the movie, and that was always, you know, I mean, that will draw a campus crowd no matter what, and it was banned in a lot of places. But there was another picture there that was an above-board movie that also happened to have tits, Ursula Andress's, as a matter of fact. It was called The Tenth Victim. It was in color, and it was Italian. And so my roommate from Chillicothe went to see it, and he came back, and I said, well, what'd you think? And he said, well, they was all speaking Italian. The words was written across the bottom of the screen. They was all speaking Italian. I thought, okay, I'm in Columbus, Ohio. 1965, this is what it's like. And then I thought you couldn't top that, but then we went downtown to the Palace to see Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf with Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton. And as we came out of the movies, there was a couple, an older couple walking behind us. And as they passed us, he was saying to her, that's what all they do in college, Margaret, drink and fuck, that's all. Well, he certainly got the movie. I thought, that's okay.
Oh, my goodness.
I had a lot of fun. But now, having said that, I have to say, there were like three theaters right around campus, and they showed a lot of movies that were geared towards the campus population. So while the great big movies were downtown at the Cinestage, Hunt Cinestage, and the Lowe's Ohio, up along State Street, there were a couple of theaters that were showing all the sort of hippie and go-go movies from England in that period, and all the surf, the Bikini Beach movies and all that kind of stuff. So there was but they were also showing like really good stuff. And we had a very active group not a film school. They were just starting a film program. There were people who were like rabidly interested in movies. And it was that period, you know, it was the 60s and with Easy Rider and all of these, what they called youth pictures, because the studios were trying to garner our demographic. So they used to fly in people from all over the place. And so I was the film critic for the Ohio State Lantern. They'd fly people in, and I would, you know, I'd talk to these studio executives all the time about the new direction in movies. It was pretty cool, actually.
Did any of those movie executives ever give you flack for writing a bad review?
Oh, yeah. But, not flack so much. What are they going to do? I mean, you know, they're reviews.
You look in every review and you say, is there something in here that I can learn? And a lot of times there's nothing. A lot of times, you know, you have know-nothing reviewers, or you have people who have an agenda, or they're angry about something, or they're people who have what I call the critic's disease, which is you, because you're a critic, you're forced to see everything. And so when you see something that you kind of like, you tend to overpraise it because you have to sit through so much crap. And then when you see something that's really crappy with a capital K, you tend to go after it with tongs. You know, you forget the human beings made the movie. And I've gotten reviews like that. You know, I mean, I wrote an Oscar show one year and a major newspaper started the review by saying, writing like this should be a capital crime. And I thought to myself, does he know what a capital crime is? They kill you. They cut off your head. That is a capital crime. You go to the chair. You go to the chamber. Really? I wrote a television show and that's what he thinks should happen? I mean, what a lousy metaphor to use. And it's mean-spirited, and I know where it comes out of the frustration of having to sit through everything. And so that's why I stopped being a critic, because I felt that I stopped wanting to have to express my opinion every day, except to people I was sleeping with. You know, I mean, that's different. They have to put up with it. But then they get a lot of other good stuff in exchange. So,
well, I'm going to move on to where I probably became most familiar with your work. And that is, of course, the game show Hollywood Squares.
Mm-hmm.
Not only did you star on it, but you were also the head writer.
I was the head writer, and I wound up in a square because Whoopi wanted me to MC, to be the host. And this was the third version of Hollywood Squares, and they didn't want to screw it up. And they said, no, they tested me because they didn't want to piss her off early in the game. Because you really don't want to piss Whoopi off, you know. As she always says, you don't go near a black woman when she puts her hand on her hips. She means business. So, you know, and there was Whoopi standing there with the hands on the hips. And they said, okay, we'll test him. So they tested me. And they said, well, you know, you're not really mainstream. But we'll put you in a square. How about that? They put me next to Whoopi, thinking somehow I would tame her. But, you know, there's no taming her. And they also didn't realize that. That she's really a Jewish gay guy, and I'm really a black woman. So we meshed beautifully.
And we had a great time. For 6 years, we carried on. And, you know, she didn't change, obviously.
So how is a show like that put together? Because I think as a kid watching it, it just kind of, to me, seemed like, oh, it's these nine people. They just get together and tell jokes and everything works out brilliantly. But
that's the whole idea. That's what we want you to walk away with. We want you to believe. We want you to tune in thinking, oh, it's a party again tonight for half an hour. Well, we only shot 36 days a year. And that was because we did five a day. And we worked on weekends, which is when a lot of actors are available, when they're not doing their other gigs. So we worked two weekends a month. We would shoot five shows on a Saturday, five shows on a Sunday. And we wound up doing 36 weeks of a 52-week year that way. So as a head writer, there was a staff of people who were just writing questions. And there was a staff of people who were just writing jokes. This was not like a gigantic staff. There were two or three people. But we would have to, we would assemble a packet for each star when they came in the morning of the questions that they would be asked if they were selected by the contestant. We didn't give them the answers. They were never allowed to. They could know the answer. We never gave them the real answer. And we told the contestants that because we felt if the contestants thought that the squares always had the real answer, they just agree with them all the time, and then there would be no game. Mm-hmm. So we didn't give them real. We gave them a bluff answer, which was something that could be the answer but wasn't. And then if we at the beginning we gave everybody a joke they could do if they wanted to, and we began cutting back on that when we realized you only give jokes to people you know are funny. And you know, and then the biggest laughs will come from people who are not supposed to be funny. Like, you know, Garth Brooks would get a huge laugh off of
off of a joke, which they weren't expecting. So we learned to give him some stuff. But and he knew how to play it. But most people just would thump through the joke, or it would sound a little heavy-handed. So we would troop in at 9 o'clock in the morning, and I would go around to all of the eight others and brief them on what they were doing. And then we would shoot three shows and have lunch and have a lot of wine and come back and shoot the two more. And it would play sequentially during the week. The first show we shot was the Monday show and so forth. So the Thursday and Friday shows, which were the after wine shows, were a lot looser than Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. But we discovered from marketing people that the audience on Thursday and Friday was always bigger because people at the end of the week would come back and would want to see something that would take their minds off the week they were having. So the audience, in other words, was in the same mindset that we were in when we shot the thing. So the Friday shows were often a free-for-all, and that was the most fun. That was how we did it. We had regulars, Gilbert Gottfried, Caroline Ray, Brad Garrett was on a lot. There were a couple of others who were on often because they were you know, you could count on them to be funny and play the game and be reliable. And then we had theme weeks where we would have huge stars, you know, Antonio Banderas and Melanie Griffith promoting a picture. We did a comic relief week with Billy Crystal and Robin Williams and Whoopi. I had a great time. It was, and I miss it. My accountant misses it even more.
Well, I have to ask about this next topic because I think it's probably one that everybody wants to hear about. That is the Star Wars Holiday Special.
Oh my God! I thought it was going to be my illicit weekend with Zac Efron. Okay, well,
no, we can touch base on that in a minute.
No, he's in Australia with a girl. I can't lower myself to discuss it.
Okay, this Star Wars show. What the hell? Can I? I just got to ask you, Bruce.
Everybody, what was going on? That's the first question everybody asks, and that gives you some idea of how old they are and where in their lives they discovered this thing. Because when we did it in 1977, again, before you were born, I'm sure, it was not unusual. I mean, there were lots. It was before just cable had just come in, but there was no internet. And cable was introducing the world to a larger universe than the three or four stations that were in each city. Under the old kind of television, there were lots of these variety specials where you would have weirdly themed things with people who did or didn't belong in them. And this was not surprising. Now, how it happened was George Lucas had made Star Wars had been out for a year and a half, and he was about to start shooting The Empire Strikes Back. And he wanted to stir the pot because that wasn't going to come out until the following year. So he had 10 stories, and he said he was going to make 6 movies, which he eventually did make. And then he had these other 4 stories, which he sold into various other media. And the last one was the one he sold CBS. It was, I think, if I'm not speaking for George, I believe this is what he believes, that they were going to turn it into some kind of an original musical. And he didn't, I don't think, want to be involved in that, but he sold them the story thinking that's what they would do. And I think when he found out what they were really doing, he disappeared. He went back to Lucasville. He went back to Marin and kind of just, he installed a couple of people who he thought were going to execute his vision, but they were steadily overruled by the network, who wanted to have a certain kind of show. They wanted a show with a lot of stars and all that. And the unfortunate part of the show was, what George had sold them was, the lead characters were the Wookiees. And the Wookiees speak no known language in this or any other universe. And they sound like fat people having orgasms. You know, trust me, I know. Please, I've been there. So it was difficult to write this. So first of all, a lot of it had to be written in subtitles to translate. And of course, back then, nobody on TV, but you know, my friend from Columbus, I mean, he didn't know from subtitles. And this was, yes, this was 12 years later, but still, the American audience, by and large, did not go to movies with subtitles, and certainly nobody watching television read subtitles. It's ironic because now at least half of the Star Wars movies are subtitled because they're all speaking some language from some other solar system. So, but then because we couldn't have subtitles, we had to have stars explaining what the Wookiees were saying. So we had Art Carney as an intergalactic Tupperware salesman, so he could translate for Chewbacca's wife, Mala. That was her name.
Mala, yes.
Anyway, so we had to write. He gave us the story. We had to write the scenes with the stars that also brought on the variety performances by Jefferson Starship and Diane Carroll and Cirque du Soleil and. Harvey Korman as Julia Child, intergalactic Julia Child. And then the legend, my legendary for me part of it was, we had Carrie and Harrison and Mark, C-3PO and R2-D2 on the Millennium Falcon flying home to the Wookiee planet for Life Day, a holiday George invented that he thought would be like Festivus for the rest of us, but not so much. And they made a stop, a pit stop on Tatooine, home of the cantina. And so we had a scene with all the aliens in the cantina. And the person who ran the cantina, a very strong woman, Bea Arthur, mm-hmm. in her Statue of Liberty period. And Bea was a Broadway diva, and she wanted to do a number, and she did a number. And to me, that was the highlight, Bea Arthur singing to the aliens. Now, what happened was, the show went out Thanksgiving weekend of 77 on a Friday night. It did very well in the ratings. The critics kind of went, hey, what is this? Because it was not that unusual from Wayne Newton at SeaWorld. It was the same kind of thing. And then it kind of, you know, was buried and went away. It never repeated, and nobody knew about it. And then comes the internet, and people in the interim, there's a generation of people who not only saw Star Wars, but they grew up watching the first three movies on VHS. They never even went to the theaters. They were too young. They're going over the internet looking for everything Star Wars, and they come upon this piece of work, and they kind of looked at it, and they go, what is George, how could you betray us this way? I mean, they got angry because by them, Star Wars was a religion. So they couldn't believe how this happened. And, you know, it's like, what were you, you know, did aliens take you away and make you do this? And he was getting death threats, and it got really ridiculous. And this thing, which had been buried for at that point, 25 years, suddenly surfaced. And it became this sort of cultural linchpin. And then it went away again. And every time George has made another Star Wars movie, which he said he never would do, but meanwhile, he's made three and two related ones. And every time one comes out, it comes back. You know, it comes back like some sort of a chronic cough. There's another generation of people who have discovered this horrible holiday special on the internet, and they come after you, and it just cracks me up. I figured, well, if we had known 40 years ago that people would still be talking about this, we would have paid closer attention. Also, you have to remember it was 1977. We were all chemically altered. You know, Carrie and I were snorting the sweet and low, so. There was, you know, anything we could put a straw into. So those were those days.
Okay.
And those of us who survived them are here to tell the tale.
All right. Well, thank you for that. I got to say, Bruce, that was fantastic, that story. I appreciate it. Thank you so very much. But let's talk a little bit about your songwriting as well. You've penned quite a few.
You know, I do parody writing. I mean, I basically do parody writing, except I had a couple of lucky strokes with disco, uh-huh. oddly enough, because I wrote the first draft of one of the great films of all time called Can't Stop the Music. Mm-hmm. It was the Village People musical, and I wrote the first draft, and then I quit because the producer, who was insane, kept having me rewrite it for different actresses who were never going to do it. And Valerie Perrine wound up doing it. And it was a legendary turd. And but I met, in the course of it, I met the guys who created the Village People, Jacques Morali, the late Jacques Morali, and the late Henry Belolo, who were two Parisians who came to New York and saw all of these guys dancing in discos and decided that they would take all these American archetypes and turn them into a disco group. And they would sing about going to the YMCA. And of course, it was a landslide. And it got this movie made. And after that was all over, Jacques and I were friendly. And he said he ran a club in Paris called the Crazy Horse. And the cast was about 50 topless Amazons. They were all the women. You had to be a minimum of 6 feet to get in there. And they were all worked topless. So it was like, I don't know, going through Muir Woods. There were all these gorgeous women with huge boobs, and they would lip sync. And he would get famous singers to come in and do a record, an original song. And they would come out and they would lip sync. And he got Eartha Kitt to do one. And he called me and said, "Darling, I think you should write this song for Eartha." He sent me the track and the title, "Where Is My Man?" A question that I am asking to this day. And we recorded it. And it was a big hit when they did it. And he got it released in France as a record, and it went to number one. And subsequently, it was released all around the world where it was a big hit, except in the U.S. where they wouldn't play disco records on the radio. And that was how you broke records back then. So they would put out what you should call the expression, a 12-inch. And that would be bought by people who ran discos and would play the records there. So, but it brought Eartha back, and she wound up like riding the back of that. We did an album, which that was a big hit. And then did one more thing with him. I did a Village People album, the last Village People album, which had a song called Sex Over the Phone, which was a big hit, banned by the BBC. So, of course, it went to number one in England.
Of course.
And I mean, and that is my kind of above board lyric writing career. I never got serious about it. At one point, I called all my songwriter friends and said, "Let's write together." And they all said, "Yes, let's." And then nothing ever happened. Because, you know, that wasn't, I'd written lyrics to other people's music. I wrote parody lyrics to, you know, songs that were already established. But to actually sit down like a lyricist was a muscle I'd never worked. And it just never happened. That's why, you know, because most lyricists write a lyric and then the composer comes in and writes the song, or they sit in a room and write the song together. Mm-hmm. And I've done that with a few things. I've written a bunch of candidates for title songs for movies, and they never made it. I wrote a great song with Henry Krieger, who wrote Dream Girls for Lost in America, Albert Brooks' movie, but he went with another song. And I literally wrote the title song for Muppets in Space. And they went with somebody else. So I had a I did a piece of special material with Glenn Rovin for Jane Krakowski to do on the American Comedy Awards. And we got an Emmy nomination for that, which was amazing. We lost to a guy who wrote a nursery rhyme about a whale. So there you go.
There you have it.
No good. Well, Bruce, goes unpunished.
Well, I was going to say, I have just a couple more questions. I appreciate you chatting with me here, but let's talk just about your next big thing that many people know you for is that you had a long tenure as a writer for the Oscars.
This is true.
How'd you fall into that particular role?
Oddly enough, I had written for individual people like Bette Midler, who I've written for only 50 years, which is difficult because she's 36. But I've written for her for so long. And when she would be on the Oscars, we'd write what she was going to do. And other people I wrote for as well. And the same guy who produced Can't Stop the Music got the Oscar producing gig. And it was years later. So the stink of Can't Stop the Music was off him, more or less. And so he asked me to come and do it. And, of course, it wound up being the landmark year that Rob Lowe did Proud Mary with Snow White. And he had Alan Carr was his name. He had a lot of great ideas and a lot of ridiculous ideas. And because of his own personal Looney Tunes-ness, the show, there were lawsuits and things, and the show is remembered as being a big disaster when, in fact, it had among the highest ratings the Oscars have ever had. And but it was a very polarizing show. Nevertheless, I survived and went on to write 23 more of them. So that was how I got involved. You know, it was my friend who was embarking on this thing thought, okay, I'll drag this guy down with me.
Well, I imagine it's a big undertaking to plan out that event.
Oh, so, it's huge. Just like the Super Bowl.
Yeah. But
generally, I mean, this year is, of course, everything this year is way different. If it were a typical year, they'd be sitting down right now and working out who would be hosting the show, or if there would be a host of the show. And because I think probably they would like to have a host again, because it worked one year, but not for that reason. And the second year, it didn't work. So so that's when they start doing that. And in the old days, they used to give honorary awards on the show, but they added about 45 minutes to it. And it's so long that they relegated those to a banquet that the Academy holds. And then they show like a 1 minute précis of those awards. So there's nothing much to write until they announce the nominees. And then you know what you're writing about, the shows that are going to be honored, the movies. And also, you know, who will be on the show, who's not going to exercise the ritual taking of umbrage, who's going to show up anyway. And then it's 6 weeks of frenzy, a feeding frenzy, getting it written. And it tends to be the host, since most of the hosts lately have been people who have television shows and they have a writing staff, they bring their writing staff over. So whatever crumbs are left for the other writers who actually have to write the show are thrown around town, and a few people wind up coming in and doing that. So there's rarely a marriage of the two, in my experience.
Okay.
But yeah, and you know, everybody, it's like playing in the Super Bowl. You know, if you fumble, it's okay if you fumble in a game early in the season, but to fumble in the Super Bowl is something you carry the rest of your career. And the same thing on the Oscars, you know, since the world watches that show, so everybody wants to be brilliant. And so everything you write for them gets cleared by, you know, more people than the KGB would ever think of having. I mean, it's insane how many people. I mean, the holistic gardener of the, you know, Wonder Woman's gardener tells you what he thinks she should say.
Final question. You're known for a lot of your T-shirts, and how many do you own?
Wow. You know, several thousand. I have a collection. A lot of them, the assistant calls every now and again, and we have what we call the Home for Aged T-shirts, which is out in the valley. And they're the ones that I can live without, but I think that they're worth having around because they're either great jokes or they are souvenirs of certain things that, you know, that will hold. And he keeps saying, oh, you're an eBay auction waiting to happen. So fine. And then I keep a lot, you know, I keep a few hundred in the house and I keep adding to them. Although, you know, when you're in quarantine, why bother? You can only wear them on Zoom.
Right.
So, but yeah, I figured, you know, with a body like this, you got to show it off. And my mother always made me dress up. I hated it. And I think, as soon as I got to California, where you can go places in your underwear and they don't care. And this is even before Madonna was wearing it as her outerwear. I thought I can get away with. I love living here because I don't have to dress up. Then I went to Hawaii. We don't even have to wear shoes.
Well, Bruce, do you have any social media or a website or anything you'd like to let people know about?
Sure, you get in touch with me if you want. There's a website called We Got Bruce, as in Harvey Weinstein, wegotbruce.com. It is a fan site, and it is monitored by a guy in Nashville who is a big fan of mine, who I've become friends with. And he knows what I'm doing more than I know. And he posts it on there, and I go, oh, really? Is that happening? I had no idea. Because he'll find something somewhere. So, and he can always get anything you need to get to me. Gotten to me.
There you go. Bruce Valanche, it has been a blast. Thank you so very much. I really appreciate it.
Wonderful stirring the ashes of my Columbus days.
Yes, yes. Hey, everyone. This episode is brought to you by World's Greatest Comics. They're located at 5974 Westerville Road in Westerville, Ohio. They got everything you need for your comic book fandom. I mean, they got graphic novels, toys, comic book supplies, collectibles, posters, back issues, current issues, and they even have one world-class pull system. So if you never want to miss a single issue of your favorite comic, sign up for the pull system, and every time it comes in, it'll be pulled and held for you at the register. So check them out online at wgcomics.com, or you can find them on Facebook. Just look for at @WGComics, and you can even stop by the store if you're in the area. Once again, it's located at 5974 Westerville Road in Westerville, Ohio. And tell them that you heard about the store from John Orlando on the PVD cast. Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. My conversation with Bruce Valanche, talking about his career in Hollywood. And I hope you enjoyed this encore episode of the PVD cast. And you can let me know whether you did or you didn't by contacting me through a couple different avenues. I mean, first of all, you can shoot me an email if you like. My email address is johnorlando@pvdcast.com. You can leave me a message over on the Facebook and the Instagram feeds. Just search for @pvdcast. And you can find me on Twitter. My personal handle is @pvdmvp. And in case you want to let some folks know where they can hear the PVD cast, well, there's a couple different ways you could do that as well. Of course, pvdcast.com, the online home of yours truly, is probably the easiest place to get the PVD cast, but it's also available through all of those major podcasting outlets, you know, like iHeartRadio, Spotify, Stitcher Radio, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts. Basically, go to your favorite podcasts platform, go into the search bar, put PVD cast. Sometimes you have to put PVD cast John Orlando, and you should be able to find it. And don't forget that if you listen to an episode, please rate, review, and subscribe. Rating and reviewing helps me out in the algorithm, and subscribing means that you're never going to miss an episode of the PVD cast. And don't forget that every Monday night, I do a Facebook broadcast through the Facebook page. Once again, that Facebook page is @PVDcast, where I play this week's episode. I also interact with folks who send over comments and whatnot. It's an awesome time. I really love doing it. That is every Monday night, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, once again through the Facebook page of the PVD cast. And lastly, I'd like to remind you to check out my good friends, the Three Geeks podcast. You can find their content over at threegeeks.ninja. That is their website. And check out all the cool things they got going on. They actually also simulcast the Facebook broadcast of the PVD cast every Monday night as well. And those guys are some awesome dudes with some great content. Check them out. Once again, that's threegeeks.ninja. And lastly, I just want to mention I got some great guests lined up for the next few weeks. So keep on listening to the PVD cast. And with that, I'm going to get on out of here. Thanks once again for checking out the episode. And I will chat at each and every one of you later. Stay righteous and stay independent. Has been a production of John Orlando Enterprises, LLC, copyright 2021.